My guest today, Michael Kahel, although living in Osaka, Japan for the past 12 years, writes extensively on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. In addition to writing a monthly column for an Irish-language magazine, his work has been published by a number of journals and websites, including Antiwar.com, Arab News, Dissident Voice, Foreign Policy Journal, Information Clearinghouse, Khalij Times, Pakistan, Middle East Monitor, Palestine Chronicle, Tehran Times, The Nation in Pakistan, and The Washington Report on the Middle East Affairs. Mike is one of the few Middle East analysts who has challenged the prevailing consensus and the Arab uprisings, which is why I'm having him as a guest today. For the past couple of months, he has been writing about some of the more prominent and likely supporters of Arab democracy in op-eds such as, quote, El Baradei, Soros' man in Cairo, the junk bond Teflon guy behind Egypt's nonviolent revolution, Egypt, a virtual smoking gun, and his latest piece, Mideast Democracy, Israel's Diamond in the Rough, end quote. These and other published articles on such subjects as the Israel lobby, 9/11, the quote-unquote war on terror, the Iraq war, and WikiLeaks can be found at his website. That's Mike Okahela, spelled MIDHCOCATHAIL.wordpress.com, as well as his new blog, The Passion Attachment. Many of Mike's earlier articles have been made into highly entertaining and informative YouTube videos, the most recent being It's the Occupation, Stupid, which is featured on the website of the Council for the National Interest in Washington. We reached Mike in Osaka, where it is now 1:25 in the morning. Welcome, Mike Okahela, to Takes on the World.
Thanks, Jeff.
Glad to have you up at this early hour, one day ahead of us. Since you were in Osaka, I want to begin with your giving a brief update on the situation in Japan following the tsunami and the meltdowns of the Fukushima nuclear plant, which seems to have vanished from our headlines, although the New York Times had something on it today. Where is Osaka in relation to the Fukushima site, and how has Osaka been affected?
Right. We're about 500 miles south west of Fukushima. So it's amazing that we actually haven't been affected really at all. It's hard to imagine that we're living in the same country. Even you know, just after it happening, people were going about their business as if nothing had happened. It's only when I came home and watched the internet that you know you realize. I mean, people were probably more aware of what was going on in America or back home in Ireland than I was living down here.
Well, we followed it closely here because a couple of our California coastal towns, including one in our county, did suffer some damage, but nothing like we saw happening in Japan. As I mentioned in my introduction, you've been uncovering and writing about outside influences in the Arab uprisings, of which most people are unaware. Where you and I have differed is the extent of these outside influences from the National Endowment of Democracy and its components, Democratic and Republican Institutes, George Soros, Freedom House, and the International Center for Nonviolent Conflicts, Peter Ackerman, can claim credit or be blamed, depending on one's point of view for these uprisings. Please fill in the blanks as you see it.
Right. Well, initially, I guess I was swept away like everybody else with the enthusiasm of the protests, particularly in Egypt. It wasn't actually until I noticed a post on Mondo Weiss referring to an Al Jazeera program that was aired, I think it was on February 9th, called Egypt Seeds of Change. And so I watched this anyway, and the reporter said, this is not a spontaneous uprising. And they interviewed some of the April 6th youth movement that were shown organizing and directing the uprising from the start. It was a behind-the-scenes look at the April 6th youth movement. And then there was this interview with a Serbian called Serge Popovic. They didn't say whether Popovic had actually trained the April 6th activists in Serbia or in Egypt, but they interviewed one of the April 6th leaders. I think his name was Mohammed Adel, And he traveled to Belgrade in 2009 for 1 or 2 weeks training. So that made me suspicious. I started looking into the background, and you know, I found out that Popovic had created. He was part of the Otpor youth movement that overthrew Milosevic in 2000. And in 2003, then he set up a group called CANVAS, Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, which was funded by Freedom House and Peter Ackerman's group, the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict. And the more I looked into it, you know, a lot of people would look on Ackerman as this, you know, idealist who believes in nonviolence. But if you look at some of his connections and his background, you start to wonder. For example, he made his money under Michael Milken, the junk bond king. And but unlike Milken, who went to jail for 10 years, Ackerman, I think Business Week put it, he beat a fortuitously timed retreat to the International Strategic Center or Institute in London 4 months before Drexel Burnham Lambert went into bankruptcy. Then he returned to nonviolent strategizing. Even more suspicious, in 2008, he attended the Herzliya conference, and he participated.
That's in Israel.
The major, I think it's national security policy making conference, and he participated in a roundtable discussion entitled "The Challenge of Radical Islam." And around the table with him were Uzi Landau, Ariel Sharon's Minister for Internal Security, a current member of the Knesset for Avigdor Lieberman's Israel Betanu, and you had Judith Miller, the so-called reporter who lied America into the Iraq War, and Stephen Emerson, the so-called terrorism expert that's played a major part in the Islamophobia that's gripping America. And I discovered I think it was only yesterday, that Ackerman co-wrote an op-ed in 2005 with Michael Ledeen in the LA Times. It was called "Say You Want a Revolution." So I think when you start looking at these people's connections, a lot of them go back to Israel. A lot of them, you know, have intelligence connections. And the neocons are very much involved in this. I can't think of any neocon. Maybe you might be able to help, but I can't think of any neocon who is not enthusiastic about the Arab uprisings.
Actually, I wanted you to tell us who Michael Ledeen is. Some of those who might remember him from Iran-Contra and the Yellow Cake, but you might fill us in on who he is.
Right. Well, Michael Ledeen is a student of Machiavelli, and he has been involved in a lot of Machiavellian escapades. Very closely related to Israel. I think he's a scholar, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. But it's surprising. A lot of people wouldn't expect to see somebody like Peter Ackerman associating with the likes of Michael Ledeen, but I think it shows that you know, this democracy promotion establishment and the, you know, the more militaristic neocon agenda are two sides of the same coin.
Well, actually, this is where I have questions. The neocons, Ledeen particularly, have over the years called for chaos in the Middle East.
Right.
They use that word, chaos, actually, that this benefits the U.S. But from what I see, these uprisings in the Middle East, certainly they began before the Obama administration and would not have obviously these were not were set off by the immolation of the peddler, the street peddler in Tunis, but they have seemed to have come at a very difficult time for the Obama administration, which doesn't know which way to turn, because there are so many uprisings going on at once that in the long run, even though the neocons are still chortling and calling for intervention everywhere, this has not seemed to have helped the United States. Maybe you could respond to that.
Right. Well, again, just like the Iraq War didn't help the United States, it's bankrupting the United States. And I think we have to look at how the neocons, they claim to be, you know, that American interests and Israeli interests are one and the same, but the various adventures that they induce America into always seem to turn out bad for America, but they don't seem to work out too bad for Israel.
Well, I earlier in my kind of news opinion piece before I called you, it does seem, though, that things aren't working out well for Israel and Egypt. Egypt's about to establish relations with Iran, and the minister from Egypt is going to make an official visit to Gaza. So the Israelis don't seem to be as happy as the neocons here, who are supposed to who back them.
Right. Yeah, it does look like that on one level. But then again, Shimon Peres doesn't seem to have got the memo. I don't know if you saw, he was in Switzerland a while back, and he gave an interview to Israel National News, and he talked about how the Arab uprisings could benefit Israel. And then when he visited the U.S. Congress more recently, he urged everybody to aid the Arab awakening. So I'm not so sure. And there's a group that I think show an even deeper Israeli involvement. There was a report there in the Washington Post on April 17th about the U.S. secretly backing Syrian opposition groups. And it talks about how the State Department's Middle East Partnership Initiative funneled up to $6.3 million to a Syrian dissident group, the Movement for Justice and Development, through an LA-based nonprofit called the Democracy Council. And the founder and president of the Democracy Council is a guy called Jim Prince. The Post didn't mention, however, that Prince is on the advisory board of a group called CyberDissidents.org. And this group was set up a couple of years ago to promote cyber dissidents throughout the Middle East and Iran. And amazingly, it was launched by the Adelson Institute for Strategic Affairs. The Adelson Institute, as you probably know, was set up with a $4.5 million grant from Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino mogul, who was a big supporter of Birthright Israel and other far-right Zionist causes.
Ultra-right wing.
Yeah, ultra-right wing. When you see somebody, an institute that's funded by the likes of Sheldon Adelson, launching a group called CyberDissidents.org to promote online dissidents in the Arab world and Iran, the one of the advisors is Nathan Sharansky. Who was the chairman of the Adelson Institute. And actually, the founder and director of CyberDissidents.org is David Keyes, who was mentored by Sharansky at the Adelson Institute.
Sharansky, we should remind the listeners, was what they called a quote-unquote prisoner of Zion.
Right.
Which is a, with the Palestinians are the, are that, but in the Soviet Union, and he was released, and has become an ultra right wing member of the Israeli Knesset. He was not a human rights activist at all.
Not at all. No, no. He resigned from Sharon's government over the disengagement plan from Gaza in 2005.
My guest is Michael Kahal, and we're talking from Osaka in Japan, for those who just tuned in. Yeah, go on, Mike.
Right. Sharansky was a minister in Sharon's government, and he withdrew in protest over Sharon's disengagement plan from Gaza. He felt that the Palestinians needed to reform themselves before any concessions were made. But it really is amazing that this guy is still considered a human rights activist. And he had a major influence on the Bush freedom agenda. I think it was Uri Avneri referred to him as Bush's brain. Bush talked about his Sharansky's book, The Case for Democracy, which had a major influence. It was probably the only book he ever read. So Sharansky and another advisor was Bernard Lewis. Bernard Lewis, as you probably know, wrote in 1992 in Foreign Affairs an article called Rethinking the Middle East, where he advocated the Lebanonization of the Middle East, along the lines of the fragmentation of the Middle East as proposed by Oda Jinnan in 1982. It stretches credibility that the likes of Bernard Lewis and Nathan Sharansky could be genuinely promoting the human rights and freedom and democracy of Arabs and Iranians. I find it hard to believe that you have dissidents in the Arab world and in Iran who would be associated with a group that has such right-wing Zionist origins.
Well, getting back to the Arab uprisings, wouldn't you say, though, unless there were people who were demanding or denied their political rights,
yeah,
as the people of Egypt, unless there was a feeling among the people that they could actually do something, that all this behind-the-scenes work would come to naught? You have to have a people who are actually ready to go out in the streets and risk their lives. And this is something that cannot be turned on and off with a button. This is why I think this is kind of, we're seeing kind of unintended consequences, at least from the position of Washington. How would you
Right. Say? Well, Washington may not have been as surprised as you might think. There was a report in the New York Times there on February 16th, secret report ordered by Obama, identified potential uprisings. Last August, he ordered his advisors to produce a secret report on unrest in the Arab world, which concluded that without sweeping changes, the region was ripe for popular revolt. But it goes much further back than that. We don't disagree over this point. The Arab world was ripe for revolution, and the neocons and Israelis knew that as well, or better than anybody else. And I think if you look at the pro-Israelis who are involved in democracy promotion, they've been talking about this for a long time. Larry Diamond, for example. He gave a speech there to the Commonwealth Club of California in 2008, and he I think this really gets to the core of the agenda. He was talking about this bifurcated playing field in the Middle East between Islamists and autocrats. And he was very critical of Mubarak and this excuse that, you know, America has no choice. You either support the autocrats or the Islamists will come to power. Larry Diamond, I should explain, he's the founding co-editor of the National Endowment for Democracy's Journal of Democracy. And he talked about a new policy of gradual democratization that would allow time for a third alternative along the lines of the Justice and Development Party, the AKP in Turkey, a liberal, democratic, moderate Islamic party. And I think that's what they're hoping will be the outcome of these uprisings.
Well, actually, when you look at there are some disagreements now, obviously even reported in the New York Times, among the youth who are involved in these uprisings about their relationship with the United States. But one of the things, way I see this, is that people were looking for tools and were approached, but how different is this from what we saw in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, in which both the Soviet Union and later China were interested in producing revolutions in Latin America and Africa and revolutionaries in these countries used the writings of Marx and Lenin to develop revolutionary movements, which now are discredited. But wouldn't these people in these various countries be ready to use any kind of a tool that was available to them without making a commitment, ideological commitment, to, let's say, be the ally of let's say, the United States?
Right, yeah. I think that there was a desperation and that these various democracy promotion organizations were able to take advantage of that. But I still find it hard to believe that they would be so desperate that they would associate with, groups that are associated with right-wing Zionist causes. It's confusing, but one would hope that they might turn on their benefactors and go their own way, but
blowback.
Yeah.
Well, we saw it actually in the days during the Cold War when the Polish workers in Gdansk were being repressed by the Polish government. Generally, the international left did not support the Polish workers, and so you had these great union supporters, Ronald Reagan and Maggie Thatcher, reaching out to them. And right. So they took anybody's hand who would reach out to them, and this may have been the case here.
Yeah, well, I think you have very much the same people involved, and I fear that you'll see very much the same outcome. And I was just reading about a guy called Adam Michnik. I think he was one of the intellectual leaders. And I don't know if you know, but now he's the CEO of a $400 million media enterprise. You also see it in Serbia. A lot of those Otpor revolutionaries have gone on to be entrepreneurs. Some of them are even revolutionary entrepreneurs. I think that that was pushed. It was a neoliberal agenda, and I think that we're seeing the same thing here. It's very much the same people that are supporting this. You know, George Soros had an op-ed in the Washington Post a few days after the protest broke out, urging Obama to come out on the side of the protesters.
Well, Soros is also hated by the Israelis because he at least in his actions and statements is not a Zionist, and so he's hated by everybody.
Right, yeah. But actually, I did a little bit of research on Soros' connection to Israel in that piece. I wrote El-Baradei, Soros' man in Cairo. And you know that he was a close friend of Tom Lantos and also a funder. I think it's interesting that Lantos, when he was co-chairman of the Congressional Human Rights Caucus, he knowingly deceived his co-chairman and the public about the identity of Naira, the Kuwaiti nurse whose incubator atrocity story helped justify the first Gulf War. A friend of Lantos said that he shared a common drive for promoting democracy and human rights with his close friend Soros. Another Zionist that Soros supports is Charles Schumer, and he also it's been revealed that he was funding J Street from the very start, as Philip Giraldi put it, J Street is little more than a spin-off of the existing Israel lobby to make it more palatable to the Liberal Democrats.
AIPAC Lite.
The Obama administration.
AIPAC Lite. It is an interesting situation because, for example, we have Bahrain, where the repression is terrible, where they were working, there was an attempt to speak to democracy promoters in Bahrain, and now we see the repression in Bahrain. The United States is keeping quiet. They need Bahrain.
I'm not so sure if they're that worried. We heard that about Mubarak as well, and we heard it about Saleh for a while, and now they're starting to pull back from Saleh. It was pretty much the same thing in the earlier color revolutions. Shevardnadze and Kuchma were allies at one stage, seemingly indispensable, but I think. That they, you know, the people behind this feel it's time for a new paradigm or a new dispensation, and some may have the autocrats may survive, but I think most of them will be swept away in this. I was wondering if you I thought of you when I was researching Ackerman's group, the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict, and I don't know if you know, but your old friend Stephen Zoon is
Zunis, yes.
is an academic advisor
yes.
to the group.
Yes, yes. Well, we have a couple of calls coming in. Let's get our first call.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, Jeffrey, this is Robert. I'm curious if Israel's indirectly behind all these revolutions and uprisings, how are they going to transform it to their own benefit? How do they control it and then transform it in the end? What is, you know, what's the long, far-reaching plan?
Right. I think there are a lot of factors involved.
Thank you, Robert.
I think we're seeing a lot of chaos. And chaos always benefits Israel. You can see, Barak was looking for more money because of the new security situation. It's also another excuse for not making peace. It also directs attention away from their occupation. I think that they're hoping that these new liberal democratic regimes will be more friendly to Israel. A common theme you see in a lot of these democracy promoters, especially Carl Gershman, he talks about the anti-Semitism in the Arab world. He was at an ADL conference in Rome in 2004, entitled "Anti-Semitism: A Threat to Democracy." And he said, whatever their differences, the Ba'athists and Islamists share a visceral hatred of liberal values that finds its most potent expression in the vilification of Israel and the Jewish people. So I think they're hopeful that, you know, with the new liberal democratic regimes, that they'll be able to curb some of what they call hate speech in the Arab world. There are a lot of factors, but I think the economic one is probably primary. You're going to see what happened in Eastern Europe in the aftermath of the color revolutions. You're going to see an opening up of these societies to further exploitation. And actually, it's interesting, Robert Kagan had an op-ed recently, and he mentioned that Lieberman and McCain had just come back from Egypt with the message that the Egyptians were looking for foreign investment. Kagan was also proposing a transition czar, somebody that would be able to handle this in the White House. Kagan has been very much involved in this. He was part of the working group on Egypt, and they've been advocating democratic change for the past couple of
years. Yemen, it creates a number of problems, and even in Libya, although Al-Qaeda has been convenient, and whatever it was in the beginning, it certainly has enlisted people who are jobless and are outraged at the U.S. and Western continuation of centuries of imperialism from the West. And we see actually at Guantanamo, someone who was formerly in Guantanamo is now a leader among the Libyan rebels. So there's a lot of questions about what is happening there. And it seems like the Libyan rebels are a mixed bag of people who want out from under the Gaddafi dictatorship, but also a number who have been playing ball with the United States. And of course, Lieberman, or at least McCain, was in Libya, of course. He wouldn't miss that either. Well, what's your thoughts about Libya?
It's easy to mix them up.
Well, they usually travel as a team. Well, what are your thoughts on Libya?
Yeah, actually, McCain there talking about the Libyan rebels being his heroes. Again, you know, Lieberman and McCain were all over those color revolutions in Georgia and the Ukraine. They just keep popping up. I'm amazed that they seem to be supporting groups associated with Al-Qaeda. I think Libya probably sent more people to Iraq than any other country, but they don't seem to be worried about the Islamic threat in Libya. I think, Elliot Abrams, another major booster of the Arab Spring, He talked about Libya being a relatively new concept, and I think you might see the breakup of Libya into two or three parts.
Mike, we have come down. I see the end of the hour. I want to let people know how they can get your writings, and I'm going to repeat this, the website. I had it here.
Do you want me to?
Well, here it is. It's the website is got a pencil, folks. MAIDHCOCATHAIL.wordpress.com. Or else you could just Google The Passionate Attachment, and that is his new blog. The Passionate Attachment, of course, is the U.S. relationship to Israel. I really appreciate Mike having you as our guest this morning and being up so late or early, and it was great talking to you.
You too, Jeff. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.